time then for Esther started dismantling the drum.
Yes.
She's somewhat in awe of Gary. Not surprising. Good evening.
Good evening.
I've got a question for you. No PowerPoints tonight, just a straightforward question. Are you wearing golden handcuffs? Are you wearing golden handcuffs? We'll leave that there for the moment. And just what? Farmers and hunters have been capturing monkeys for a long time. These days you probably go out with your dart gun or one of these rocket powered nets. I don't know whether you've ever seen those. They sort of have a net with rockets on and they sort of fire the things up. It goes over and sort of covers a large area and you catch everything in it. Well, obviously, that's quite a recent kind of development. But farmers and hunters have been capturing monkeys for a long time. Do you know how they do it? You got it, Sharon. What they do is they take a gourd, you know, a large fruit with a hard skin, cut a hole in it, hollow it out, but they make sure that the hole is only just big enough for the monkey to fit the hand through, okay? In the gourd, I mean, sometimes they use jars. They've even been known to use termite hills because they've got a hard outside, and then they sort of use that as the sort of skin, if you like. And then they put in the hole that they've created, nuts, sweets, anything like that, anything the monkey wants. Monkey goes by, smells this, goes to there, thinks, oh, there's something nice in there, sticks its hand in, grabs it, and then, of course, as you grab it, your hand is now bigger, isn't it? It won't come out the hole. Generally, people wouldn't be fooled by that. I say generally, just in case, all right? You'd think, well, tough, I can't have it, and you take your hand out. But the monkey wants what's in there. It's got his hand on it. I want that. But he can't get it out of the hole. So it's pulling and it's pulling. Can't get it out, and it's not going anywhere. But it wants what's there. And then while it's doing that, the hunter comes up and captures the monkey. The monkey isn't actually trapped, is it?
No.
The monkey can get out. It's not like a mouse trap, rat trap, cage thing where you're in and you've had it. I mean, as a youngster, what my dad told me was that, you know, about catching birds. He said, if you want a pet bird, the thing to do is to get a wooden box, prop it up, get a stick underneath it, put some seed down, stay there. When the bird gets under, on the string, pull the stick away and you capture the bird. I sat there for hours waiting for a bird to turn up. Nothing turned up, so I gave that up as a bad idea, all right? But if something had turned up, the bird had gone under, I pulled the stick, you know, box drops down, the bird is trapped. It can't get out, can it? But the monkey is not trapped, is it? What is holding the monkey there? Its hand. But it's only holding it there because it values what's in its hand. It wants what's there. And it's holding on, and it won't let go. And we think, oh, stupid monkey. But I say to you again, are you wearing golden handcuffs? Golden handcuffs was a phrase that was used sort of, I think it's, well, I first came across it in the 90s. And the idea was that, well, it was during the sort of real boom years when people were making money after money, you know, the interest rates were high, and people were investing and you're getting loads of money back. And people were in investment firms. And the best investors were kept at the company, not only by the salary, but by other things that were offered. I mean, there were things like really expensive motor cars, you know, what's your dream motor car? Well, you can have it if you stay with us. But if you leave, you give the car back. So the phrase was used, golden handcuffs, because it was an incentive, something to keep you there, something that you valued, something that you thought, I really want that. And so-and-so might be paying more, but I really want this car or whatever it was. And the phrase was used, golden handcuffs. Again, the people weren't held at that company. There was nothing physically holding them. What held them there was the value that they placed upon what they got. So the monkey values what's in its hand, so much that it won't let go of it. And these people at these companies were trapped, if you like, by the value that they placed on what they were given. Are you wearing golden handcuffs? They wanted something. They grew used to having it. We grow used to so much things. You know, if you get a pay rise, wow, this is fantastic. But a few months down the line, it's not fantastic anymore. It's normal. Yeah? It's always easy to go up rather than down because you get used to it. I mean, it's like that with so many things. Things that you might take as a luxury, a fantastic thing. You know, this is great. Oh, this is so good. Becomes so routine. And the golden handcuffs syndrome is when we have something. Initially, it's a luxury. Initially, it's, wow, it's a benefit. But after a while, it becomes necessity. We've got it and we don't want to let go of it. And we're like the monkey. We don't let go. There's nothing physically holding us, but we're retained. We just come back from holiday in Madeira. And I think, for me, the summation of Madeira is everywhere is on a hill. All right? There are no flat bits, really. Everything's on a hill. And we went for a tour around. And we went in a Land Rover. And the guy's driving us around, you know, sort of off the beaten track, green laning, effectively. There was one bit where there were another four people in the truck with us, the Land Rover with us. And as we're going along this narrow road at one point, the guy in the front seat, who was near to the side that was dropping away, says, "There's no barrier at this side. What happens if you go over?" And the guy who was driving says, "You never miss a corner in this country, because if you do, you never miss a second." All right? No barrier. There you go. But he was driving this Land Rover for a company, and he said he wanted his own Land Rover to be able to do this for himself. He says, "But do you know, in Madeira, they are so expensive, because obviously it's so far out, you've got to ship everything over, so that's the shipping cost." And he says, "I can't afford to buy a new one." He says, "But I found an old one." He says, "It needs work, but I've got it." He says, "Do you know, it's cost me nearly everything I have to get it." Then he made this statement, "Now I'm broke." He says, "But do you know, if you really want something, sometimes you have to sacrifice to get it." Yeah. If you really want something, sometimes you have to sacrifice to get it. Sometimes you've got to let go of something to get something else. So the monkey has to let go of the nuts to get its freedom. And sometimes we've got to take off the golden handcuffs to get something that is so much better. Are you wearing golden handcuffs? Sometimes to gain, you have to lose. And this driver, he was prepared to let go of something to get something else that he valued more. He was prepared to lose something of great worth to him to get something that he thought was of greater worth. He was prepared to trade lesser for greater in his eyes. If you've got a Bible, turn to Matthew chapter 16, please. Matthew chapter 16. We're just going to have a look through a few verses, five verses there, 24 to 28. Matthew 16, beginning to read at verse 24. Okay. Reading from the NIV, it says this. Then Jesus said to his disciples, "Whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up the cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it, but whoever loses their life for me will find it. What good will it be for someone to gain the whole world yet forfeit their soul? Or what can anyone give in exchange for their soul? For the Son of Man is come in his Father's glory with his angels. For the Son of Man is going to come in his Father's glory with his angels. Then he will reward each person according to what they have done." In one sense, the way it's phrased in the NIV doesn't actually make sense without the context. Because he's speaking to the disciples and he says, if anyone wants to be my disciple, well, they already are disciples. So there's this sort of, hang on, what's going on here? Surely they knew what a disciple was meant to be because they were disciples. You know, they'd gone through whatever, were doing whatever, and now were the thing. So how come he was telling them about being a disciple? Doesn't seem to make sense. It can be a little bit confusing, but hopefully we'll sort that out. Because we've got to set it in context. And the context starts in verse 13. We have Peter's confession, where he says, you know, Jesus says to them, who do people say that I am? Goes through different things. But Peter then turns around to him and says, you are the Messiah, the Son of the living God. Jesus says to him, it's God who's revealed that to you. But then he goes on to say, I'm going to go to Jerusalem, I'm going to be handed over to the leaders, I'm going to be mistreated, eventually I will be killed by them, but I will, you know, rise again. Peter comes to him and says, that's not going to happen to you. Jesus makes a statement, get behind me, Satan. So one minute Peter's up in the air, this is a revelation of God. Next minute, get behind me, Satan. You're minding the things of man, human concerns, not the concerns of God. But Jesus is saying to them in the section that we read, what does it mean to follow me? What does it mean to be a disciple? Just in case they haven't got it, and from Peter's, the way he was talking to him, it looks as though he hadn't got it, Jesus seeks to explain. And that verse 24 literally can be sort of put across as Jesus said to his disciples, enlarging on that word where it says disciple, secondly, if anyone wants to walk in my way, if anyone wants to be where I am, if anyone wants to do what I do, if anyone wants to be like me, to walk in my footsteps, it's possible. Okay? If anybody wants to walk in my footsteps, with all the things that he puts after that, he's saying, it's possible. But here's the rub, here's the crucial point. What he doesn't say is, I'm talking to you 12 if you want to be like me. He says, if anyone. So yeah, he was addressing the disciples, but he wasn't just addressing the disciples. Because he says, if anyone wants to walk in my footsteps, if anybody wants to follow me, if anybody wants to do what I'm doing, if anyone. It appears he's saying that anyone can be like him. It appears to be saying that I can walk in his footsteps. I can do the things that he does. He's saying it to you too. If anyone. We're part of the anyone. Jesus did absolutely stunning, amazing things. He demonstrated his power over nature. Calmed storm. Walked on water. He healed the sick. He delivered the demon-possessed. He raised the dead. If anyone wants to walk in my footsteps, they can. Can we do that? Can we do that? Or are we wearing golden handcuffs? John 14, 12 to 14 says this. It's the day before Jesus was crucified. It's at the Last Supper. And he says, verily, very truly, I tell you, whoever believes in me will do the works that I have been doing, and they will do even greater things than these. Let's just go over that again. Very truly, I tell you, whoever believes in me will do the works I have been doing, and they will do even greater things than these, because I am going to the Father. He says, whoever. He didn't say, the disciples. He didn't say the apostles. He didn't say the people in the first century. He says, whoever. I'm one of those. You're one of those. So the previous statement, if anyone, now is saying whoever, and it's applying to us. It's not an exclusive statement, it's an inclusive statement, because we're all included. We are part of the anyone, we are part of the whoever. But the thing that always strikes me about this is Jesus isn't saying, you will just be able to do what I do. He says you will do even greater things. Well, if Jesus had said that we could heal like him, it would be amazing. Mm. If Jesus had said we could deliver people like him, that would be incredible. If Jesus said we could raise the dead, that would be mind-blowing. But he said something so stunning that if he hadn't have said it, it would probably be counted as heresy. He says, you will do greater things. And you know, that has stunned people down the years to the extent that they've tried to explain it away. Now, it's very difficult to explain it away because it's pretty plain and straightforward. He says, you will do greater things. And so I've said, well, it probably means in number. You know, if you take all the Christians that they are in the world and all the prayers that have been praised and the miracles that have been done, obviously it's worked out a greater number than Jesus. But I think there's more to it than that. I think it also means in extent. In Acts 19, 11 to 12, this is what it says. God did extraordinary miracles through Paul, so that even handkerchiefs and aprons that had touched him were taken to those who were ill, and their illnesses were cured. Now, I know that some evangelists pray over handkerchiefs, bits of cloth or whatever, but it doesn't actually say that. It says things that had touched Paul. He hadn't prayed over them. That simply touched him. They were taken away, laid on the ones who were ill, and they were healed. That never happened with Jesus. A woman touched the hem of his garment. But we're talking here about, I don't know, you get a tissue out, blow your nose on it, put it back in your pocket, and somebody thinks, oh, I like that. Takes it away, puts it on somebody, and obviously apart from the cleanliness aspect, you know, they're healed. Is that fantastic? If that hadn't been written down, would you believe it? Sounds a bit, well, you know, I don't really trust that. But it's amazing. But has that passed? Is that something that's done away with now and we're sort of grown up and mature and we don't need that sort of stuff anymore? I don't think so. Because Jesus said anyone and whoever. He didn't say it'll end, you know, 100 BC, AD, wherever. Anybody heard of Smith Wigglesworth? Mm-hmm. An illiterate plumber born in 1858, and the things that God did through him defy description. The first time he was used in healing, he said that a guy came to him and said, will you come and pray for my wife? The doctor said she's dying. He'd never done anything like this before, but he said, yeah, we'll come and we'll pray. And he thought, I better take somebody with me because I really don't know what to do here. So he went to one guy and said, can you pray with me? And he says, no, actually, I'm off somewhere else. So he went to somewhere, another guy, and he says, I've always heard him pray, you know, and he prays good, long, hard prayers, you know, that touch God. So I'll take him with me. So I went to see him and said, yeah, we'll go and we'll pray. So they went to pray for this woman. And because Smith Wigglesworth wasn't really sure what to do, he thought, I'll get the other one to pray first. So the other guy starts praying. And he starts praying, God, when this woman dies, will you bless this family? Will you encourage them? You know, will you strengthen the husband? And as he's praying like this, Smith was thinking to himself, God, shut him up. Anyway, he finished, and he thought, we've got to do better than this. So he said to the husband, can you pray? He says, yeah, I'll pray. So the husband started praying. He says, God, when my wife dies, you know, I pray that you will be my support, my strong pillar. And again, Smith Wigglesworth says, I was saying to God, shut him up. Well, the husband eventually finished praying. So it's come round to Smith Wigglesworth. He brought some oil with him. So he thought, I didn't really know what to do. So he says, he took the top off and just poured the lot over this woman and said, God, heal her. And she got up. If anyone wants to walk in my footsteps, if anyone wants to do the things that I'm doing, whoever, if anyone. Are you wearing golden handcuffs? Smith Wigglesworth carried out crusades in this country, in the USA, in Switzerland, Scandinavia, in Australia, and other places around the world. God did things that were stunning through him. It didn't stop in the first century. The power of God is available today. He was called the Apostle of Faith. Jesus said it was possible to walk in his way. It was possible to do the things that he did. It's true. And he said we would do greater things, and that's equally true. When the monkey has the hand in the trap, it has a choice. It's not for the chosen few. We see the example of God working through the apostles. We see the example of God working in Paul. We see God working through others down through the years. We see Smith Wigglesworth being blessed with amazing things. Is it the specially chosen ones? Is it people that God comes along and says, she is going to be used by me to do whatever? I don't think so. Jesus didn't say it was reserved for the 12. He didn't say it was reserved for special people. He didn't say it was reserved for select ones. He said, whoever, if anyone. There is a choice, but it's not God's choice, it's our choice. The monkey has a choice. If you could talk to the monkey and say to the monkey, do you want to be in captivity? I'm sure the monkey would say, no. And if it was given this straightforward choice, freedom or captivity, there's no doubt which it would pick. But it's enticed by what seems better. It's not given the straightforward choice, it's given another choice. And the results of that choice lead where it wouldn't want to go. And golden handcuffs retain us in places where really there's something better. You know, it's possible to get people to act in certain ways if you do it in carefully constructed steps. To the extent that it's been shown through questionnaires, you can actually get people to say things that are totally opposite to what they believe, because you lead them along a particular path. You give them questions that are phrased in certain ways so that as the sort of questions go, they follow the path so that they eventually get to the end where there's an obvious answer and they give it, but actually it's not what they would have given. If at the start you'd have said, do you want this or that? We can be led step by step and not always take into account the end step. We can perhaps make choices that otherwise we wouldn't make if we knew where the end was. We can say things that actually, we don't believe to be true, simply because we followed it step by step. To make the best choices, we need to strip away the other things. We need to get to the nitty-gritty. We need to understand where the choices lead. We need to understand what's really being said. And we need to understand what we really want. It appears as if there's an almost unbelievable offer on the table here, where God's saying, do you want to do more than Jesus did? And when he says you, he means each and every one of us here, because he's speaking to the whoever, and we're included in that. An unbelievable offer. But God makes unbelievable offers. Is salvation unbelievable? Yeah. Almost. It's incredible, isn't it? It's free. It's so easy. How many people turn around to you and say, it can't be that easy? Because that's unbelievable. God specializes in unbelievable offers. But God specializes in true offers. And here, God is making a true offer. Do we accept the offer that he's bringing to us? Or have we got our hands on something else that we value more? Have we perhaps got so used to other things that perhaps years back or whatever, we might have looked at and said, no, it's better this way. But we got used to that. Are we prepared to let go and sacrifice to get something better? Or have we got used to the golden handcuffs and are quite comfortable, thank you very much? Do we want what is better? Do we want what is more? Do we want to take this unbelievable offer that God is making to us? Or are the other things that we value, and for each one of us, we have to address what those things are for ourselves? Exactly what the other things are that we're holding on to and are stopping us from having what is promised by God. That is something that each one of us must address for ourselves. But it's a question that each one of us has to answer. So, do you want to take God up on his offer? Or have we got accustomed to the golden handcuffs?